Today's episode is about why fertility matters at work. In this episode, Sean and I were joined by the wonderful Natalie Silverman and Becky Cairns. It was an open and honest conversation about how employers can support their employees in the workplace while they navigate fertility treatment. Whether you are an employee or an employer, this is a must listen. Hi, I'm Kieran.
And I'm Sean. Welcome to the Male Fertility Podcast.
This podcast is dedicated to thoughtful and informative conversations around male fertility, aiming to help you navigate the emotional and medical complexities involved.
We've experienced these challenges ourselves, and we understand the importance of clear guidance, reliable information, and professional support. So, let's dive into today's episode. I'm actually quite nervous about this because literally about to introduce some podcasting royalty here in Natalie Silverman and Becky Cairns. Welcome to the Male Fertility Podcast.
Oh, thank you for having us. It's very exciting to be here, Sean. I remember that first chat of you going to do a podcast. So what did you say? You're three series in?
This is fourth now.
That is very commendable.
Thank you. Honestly, we are so grateful for all the help and advice you gave us. Everything you said back then still stands. It's very hard work. You obviously ran the Fertility Podcast for many years.
The Fertility Podcast, part of my motivation was to have a male voice because that was my personal experience of that diagnosis. So what I later did was we made some kind of different feeds. So there is a male fertility podcast feed because when you've been podcasting for 10 years and talking about a lot of things, it's trying to find a new way to organize it because your feed gets very busy, as you will find. But it's just brilliant that there is a male voice, because I remember my husband, when he was told that's what our diagnosis was, mortified and not knowing where to go. So everything that you guys are doing, it's just such an important thing. And it's brilliant that there's the podcast as well, because as I'm sure we'll talk about, we need to encourage men to talk more.
Thank you very much. And Becky, an absolute OG in the support space, past the Parent Hub's been going for quite a few years now as well. And thanks for everything you do. And thanks for coming here.
Thank you for being my favourite Instagram handle. Still, knackered knackers. I still remember when I found that. And yeah, it's just amazing what you guys are doing, the two of you, and what you've created over the last few years.
Let's not forget, you're also your mum's favourite Instagram handle and account, probably, I think.
Yes, my mum is your number one fan, isn't she, Sean?
So, I didn't know that.
She responds to all of his stories. Yeah, she tells me things that Sean's doing before I've even had a chance to see. Shout out to Sue.
Absolutely. Legend. We're delighted to have you here today. We really are, because we want to talk about the amazing work that you do at Fertility Matters at Work. So what was it that brought you together and how did that come about?
It's probably the podcast, to be honest, Sean. Becky and I met first, and I'm right in that we met at the fertility show. Was that right? Yeah. So I think you'd been a guest on my podcast beforehand, and then we met in person at the fertility show. And so we knew of each other. And Claire was somebody who was introduced to me. I don't know which order it was, but she was introduced to me through Mike Johnson Ellis from Two Dads, because Claire had a handle where she was talking about her experience in the workplace. I'd started talking about my experience through being on the radio and then ending up working for Bauer, and they own Grazia. And I'd seen that they were doing mental health in the workplace conversations. And I said to them, have you talked about fertility? And they said to me, do you want to talk about it in Grazia? So I was featured in Grazia's Womb with a View column, which then led me to be invited into the corporate space to talk. And then through the podcast, it grew a bit. And then Becky was talking about it. She'll tell you, Claire was too. And then we got together in a pub just before lockdown, and we all know what happened next.
Yeah. I think my first kind of dip into this topic in the fertility world was during Fertility Week. I can't remember the year, but it was BBC Radio 5 Live. We're doing a focus on the workplace. And so shared my story there. And actually, it's a part of my story that I hadn't really told. I talked about the donor conception part of that, but it was actually a really significant part for me. And also being a HR professional, as Claire is as well, this realization that actually there's a huge gap here in terms of understanding of what people are going through at work, but also the support that's available. And that's where I think the stars just aligned, and we all met in this pub in the Peak District just like the week before the pandemic, I think it was. And we had a table full of post-it notes of what we thought we could achieve. And it's always one of those days I look back at and think, wow, look how far we've come over the last few years. Because I think it just started off as an idea and something that we thought, actually, maybe we could do this. And now we're working with lots of big employers, conducting research, having conversations, not just in the UK, but globally, but really having, really trying to get this started in the workplace. And I know, Sean, you've been instrumental in bringing the male voice into the workplace as well, because often there's a bit of a barrier there, but I'm sure we'll talk about that later on.
Yeah, well, honestly, everything you're doing is fantastic. When you think about some of the live events that you've put on, like last, was it November?
Yeah.
Was it in the Awareness Week. Wow, that was just incredible. The voices that you had there, especially on that intersectionality panel, it was just incredible. We had everything covered. And then you get in, like you're saying, like really big companies, the leaders of those big companies really driving for that change. And it's really impressive work. So thank you on behalf of us.
But we're really keen to always bring our community together, because I think it's how we met and it's how we've just grown. And that panel was just the perfect combination of people. And also the fact that we knew we could ask so many different voices, but everybody was up for it. And even in the pre-chats, it was just so brilliant hearing the different dimensions that people can bring, because our ethos is that we say to organizations, this is a people issue. It's not a women's health issue. You can't just say it's over there. It's all people. And that's obviously where we try to bring in the male voice, but just having that representation of different people shows anybody assuming that it's not relevant to them that actually it might be, because they might then see themselves or a colleague that they might not have realized before. Because I think there's still a lot of misconceptions about who's impacted by this.
Yeah, I think we've said it many a time, haven't we, on some of the talks we've done, but where I finally opened up after a year and a half of keeping it quiet from everyone at work, I then started telling some of, first of all, my line managers, but then secondly, then my peers. And so I sat next to a girl, and then next to her was another chap, next but one to me. And when I told her, she said, Martin, who that was, that guy next but one, said, Martin and his wife went through this. Seriously, what do you guys talk about? And I was like, not that. And therein is the problem for men, but also at work. And we spend so much time at work during the kind of waking hours. And you probably know the stats, but I'd imagine the bulk of any employee going through fertility treatment is going to be in 30s and 40s.
Like you say, we spend so much of our time in the workplace, and it's impossible when you think about what you're going through, it not to impact your career. And I think your career is a huge part of your identity. And actually, when you go through a fertility struggle, your identity is challenged in many ways. And so I know in my own experience, that did seep into work. And I had these sort of feelings of failure from my own ability to conceive and my diagnosis and going through multiple rounds of IVF, that then I started feeling like I was failing at work as well. And who am I if I wanted my career, but I also wanted to be a mum. So it throws up all these different questions. And you're at that point, if you're ready to have a child, where you've probably thought about your career and actually this is going to happen next and this is where I want to go. But actually when that doesn't happen when you want it to, what does that mean for my career? So there's so many different questions that it throws up. And I think you're right, Sean, in terms of there'll be people around you that you don't even realise in the workplace who are going through it or have been through it. And we've had CEOs where we've been into organizations and they've come and said, oh, actually, yeah, I went through this 10 years ago. It was horrific. It was awful. And that is the ripple effect, I think, of opening up these conversations. You hear more and more people sharing their own stories. And that's where the power lies, I think. And that's why we always want to use real stories to bring this to life.
I never forget, we were doing a panel session face to face. And there was a guy in the room that was just like staring at me really intently through the conversation. I was thinking, oh God, he's not really enjoying this. And at the end, he came up to us and said that it was something that he'd been through a good decade or so ago, and that it was just amazing having it brought to life. He was a senior leader, as Becky had said, because we've had so many different levels of people. But he was like, I hadn't realized how much it was still impacting me. And almost, we were then trying to encourage him to talk more openly about it, because I think part of, I'm sure what this conversation will highlight, is the reluctance of men to A, talk about the difficult stuff, and B, know who to talk to about it.
Yeah, I'm going to echo something that Becky said there in terms of when I was going through our fertility journey, I was open with my employer, but I took the stress of my fertility journey into the workplace every day. So everything became harder. And I was really lucky where I had a really understanding head teacher, and they were amazing, and they structured everything so I could take some pressure off me. But I distinctly remember that feeling that heavy feeling of walking in, just walking through the door, because you've got an additional work stress.
Yeah, so you've got to put the face on, haven't you? Nothing's happened.
Yeah. And it was, at the time, I was teaching a class of schools that had additional behaviour challenges. So that in itself is stressful. Without having a fertility challenge on top of that, I learned a lot about myself in that time. It compounds, doesn't it? It builds up and just stacks on top of each other. And then you'll have a failed cycle, and then you've got to turn up on Monday and go through it all again. And it's incredibly challenging. Incredibly challenging, because really you spend so much time at work.
Kieran, do you know if there was a policy in place for fertility, or did you win the Nine Manager lottery?
I won the lottery. She was absolutely fantastic. The whole leadership team were. But there was no policy around it, because we're going back, 12 years, 13 years when we started. Oh, I don't know. If it would be interesting if I contacted the school, because I'm still in contact with people, and say, have you got something in place now? Because when people learn what I was going through as a man, and then I was approached by women and said, oh, we've been through that, my child's IVF. And it was, it opened the door, but no other men. It was very limited men working in that educational space at the time anyway. But as we said previously, once you start talking, more people come forward. But we spend most of our time at work.
We do. And I just want to pick up, you use the word lucky and grateful within there. And we hear that all the time from people who have had that good experience, that I was really lucky. I had a good line manager, or they understood. And a big part of our mission is we want to make that the norm, that it shouldn't be, like you say, the line manager lottery, who you get. And there should be a consistency of a policy in place that at least gives that foundation of support. And it's interesting what you say about the education sector as well, because it can be really difficult when you're planning cycles. And I've heard of teachers literally waiting to plan them around term time, and because when it's, you're not in term time, so that you can actually go through treatment, because otherwise it is such a difficult job. And I think that's the thing. Everybody's got a different type of work that they do. And Sean, obviously yours was very intense shift work and having to be there, that how do we make sure that across so many different industries and different job roles that people have that same support? And I think that's quite a challenge. It's quite easy when you're in an office environment where you've got flexible working and people can work remotely, but there are so many jobs out there. I'm sure people listening now who will be thinking, I'm not quite sure how that's going to work in my own workplace. And that's one of the biggest challenges I think we find.
We talk about male fertility, and we're both in the situation through Male Factor. But of course, for both of us, there was a female on the other side, someone who is having to take those needles to work and navigate that. I remember Jenna sending me a picture once, and I was like, of when she was doing it, I was like, where are you? It didn't look great. It was the toilets at Euston train station. Now, we could probably say a lot about needles in train station toilets, but this was obviously a lot more emotionally impactive. And when that really stuck with me, still got the picture, and it's wow, you haven't to go through that and try and not being really careful where you're putting stuff. And this is just, it must be draining, especially if you haven't said anything, to have to, because we all know about the appointments you don't choose when they are. It's, you're at the mercy of clinics and cycles and everything. I did it for a year and a half, like I said, where I didn't say anything, and I was covering it with sick leave, annual leave, trying to change shifts around, and that adds on a big stress and a bit of toil as well. How did you navigate that when you were going through it?
For me, I was open. I'm a bit of an open book anyway. I find it very hard to hide anything. It's just how I am. But I'd also just started a new job when I was told that I needed to go to IVF. And because of my diagnosis of being premature ovarian insufficiency, time was against us. So it wasn't even like I could say, we'll do it in a year once I'm settled into the role. And I still remember having to have this really scary conversation with my new boss, like a few weeks before I actually started the job, whilst I was still leading up to it, say, actually, just to let you know that I'm going to be going through IVF. So I'm going to need some flexibility for appointments. And she was understanding to a point. She was going through it herself. So I thought, this is amazing. I've got someone who truly understands. But she was a very different person to me and dealt with it differently. And over time, it became actually quite challenging. And so I would get the earliest appointment that I possibly could. I'd leave the house at sort of 6 a.m. It was an hour trip to get to the clinic, and then have my appointment, then try and get in the office. And I remember feeling really guilty walking in about 9:15. It's not even that late. But because everyone else was getting in at 8:30, and because I was new, people were thinking, oh, the new girl, she's late again. And that really affected me as well. I think my confidence and being able to, and I felt like I had to explain myself, I had to share. But I think that's probably more of a rare example, because we know through our research that 61% of people don't feel comfortable talking to their employer. Nearly 70% of people took sick leave, and anecdotally, that was to hide the fact that they were going through treatment. So actually, in the majority of cases, what we find is people are actually going through this incomplete silence, and they have that burden of having to juggle meetings around without anybody knowing. And I've seen people literally on their laptops in the waiting room just keep going, keep working, which for any other medical appointment, I don't think you'd expect anybody to do. But this is something that I think for many reasons is obviously the shame, and there's the stigma that still exists around this topic. It's really personal. But also, and I'd be interested in your thoughts from the male perspective, but we know particularly for women, this is very much closely linked with you're showing your hand before you're pregnant and saying that I'm intending to have a baby. And that ultimately means, and hopefully if things work out, there'll be a period of maternity leave. And we have spoken to people who have tried to hide it. It's come out through a sick note that they're having IVF. And then ultimately they've had to leave their jobs because they've been forced out, because for that employer, it was easier to do it that way than it was more expensive to have a maternity leave. So it's something that I think it's not an easy thing just to say to people, just tell your employer, get that support, because many worry about, will that affect my chances of that promotion that I've been working towards? Will they think that I'm less committed to my job now? What will they think of me? Will they think that having a baby is more important than my career? And it's one of those things that unless you've got someone you really trust, or unless your organization has that support in place with the policy and everything lined up, you have to feel very confident to be able to even approach and have that conversation in the first place. I don't know, like from your perspective, whether did that ever cross your mind? Will this impact my career?
Certainly not from my perspective. And I think what I would say is, unfortunately, it didn't. And the reason I say use the word unfortunately is because of the state of paternity leave in this country, which there are people campaigning about. Elliot Ray is doing some amazing work about that, because at most it was going to be 2 weeks. And then, like you said, that career penalty then doesn't apply really, because people take 2 weeks for a holiday. It needs to be a lot longer. And then perhaps then there'll be repercussions on the other side if you are preemptively saying to your boss that you're trying, because like you said, most of the time people don't. They do that privately behind closed doors and then make the announcement however long down the line. But yeah, how about you, Kira? I don't know. It might apply differently in teaching.
No, once again, it's because of the paternity situation. I knew I'd get... our policy said a minimum of 2 weeks. So they gave us 2 weeks, which was really good. And then my son, he just happened to come 2 weeks before Easter. So I ended up with 4 weeks. So it just happened that the holiday fell when it did. But I wasn't concerned about my career or anything like that. What I was more concerned was about my masculinity, massively. Mm-hmm. I knew that I could still be charged forward with my career, but I was worried people's perception of me would change as a man because I was coming out as being infertile or subfertility levels. That's what worried me. And subsequently, that's why I had so many mental health issues, because I thought the world was judging me. I've said it before, I was fortunate that I had such an understanding boss right at the top of the tree, but they couldn't control how other people responded to the situation because of the type of class I ran at the time. I had quite a big team that works for me, and initially I didn't speak to them about it. They thought I was just off, or I was off with stress, but actually the reasons behind the stress they didn't know until we sat down and I put it out, and they were a lot more understanding. But that was my fear. It wasn't about a career. It wasn't about what would happen in the future. It was how people were going to judge me at that moment in time, which I would imagine is how a lot of men feel.
Definitely how my husband felt. Yeah. My son's 10, and I can probably say that only in the last 18 months to 2 years, he's found a bit more peace with the experience.
Yeah. And that's, wow, that's exactly how I'd explain it. I'm at peace now. It's still part of me. And I'm still sometimes wary about when I bring things up, because not everybody will have that understanding. And it's more because I can't be bothered to deal with it, that kind of situation. But yeah, that's where I was. It was more the stigma linked to it, which is what we're trying to drive out now. And I understand it a lot more. Other people's responses to my situation is nothing to do with me. It's their issue. I know that now. But when you're actually starting off on a fertility journey, especially as a man, you don't have that understanding initially, I don't think. Not many men do anyway.
I think what we see is when we, because as part of our events within corporate organisations, we invite that organisation to ask their employees if anybody is willing to share their story. And I would say 90% of the time it's women that are coming forward sharing their stories. And it is quite rare to have a man, but we always push to say, if you've got anybody out there who's willing to speak from that male perspective, really is powerful. And I hosted one just last week, and it was actually quite a senior male in the organization who'd been through struggles, and actually they hadn't conceived in the end, and they were now childless not by choice. But him sharing, and I could see him getting emotional as he was doing it, because often it is bearing your soul and you're talking about something. And actually, I think for him, he's always been seen as quite a strong senior male, not really shown that much vulnerability. But he said afterwards what a powerful experience that was, and how many people were then reaching out to him. And the chat during the webinar was just going crazy, the emojis going up the screen, where he was just sharing this very raw personal experience that I think without us coming in and hosting that event, he probably would have never spoken about at work. And I think that's really powerful, because where we can get a man to talk about their experience, it definitely will have that impact on other men. And like you say, with that kind of shame and stigma, my favorite quote is always, shame dies when stories are told in safe spaces. And it's exactly what we want to try and do, and exactly what you guys are doing right here, right now.
Mm. More organizations, though, I feel, especially over the last maybe 6 months, because we're pushing the male conversation maybe a bit earlier with them when we're doing these awareness sessions, they're almost feeling more confident to ask for men too, because it feels like even this week, I've had some conversations with some of our members about events they're doing. And I've said, do you know if there might be any men willing to speak? And most of them are saying, yes, they are. So it feels things are changing a bit more, because again, it's that permission that's been given. And in their comms, they're saying men and women, this is a people conversation, rather than that assumption that it is relevant to just women. Yeah. And we've had around baby loss awareness last October, we had an organization come to us. They'd had the men say they wanted to do it from that kind of male perspective about the partner support. And I think the more that can be driven from organizations to encourage that male voice, the more we'll see of it. And it's brilliant. It feels really like trailblazing. That shift is starting. It's by no means anywhere near where it needs to be. But I feel that I have heard more people say yes when we've asked the male speaker question.
Yeah. You hit on something really important, which is the messaging and the language used and the inclusivity of it. And that's where it starts, because for so long, it wasn't that. It was gauged towards females. And when men are seeing that, and if you're a man going through it, then you think, it's just me. I'm not relevant because it must not be men in general. I'm the only one. And that's how I felt for so long, because there was no one talking about it or the language around. Anytime I search anything, it would be floral notes in the design and kind of yellow or pink and that. And then, men just weren't even included. So, that's such an important step. And like you said, it feels to us like things are changing as well. A few months ago, someone asked me, do I feel like that there's more men talking and that there's a sea change in the world in general in terms of like male fertility and awareness? And my immediate answer was yes. But then I had to check myself and think about it. Yeah. Because I realized that I'm talking about this every day
in some respect.
So I had to remove myself from that bubble to then take stock of what's going on. And I went back to him and said, my answer is still yes, because of the enhanced media coverage, more people with like celebrity platforms and stuff talking about it and talking about their struggles. And sometimes it's not always like a male factor isn't specifically talked about, but sometimes you can read between the lines.
We're going in the right direction with the men. And the main thing that proved that to me was when we set out to do series three, talking to men and their real stories, me and Sean had the conversation of, can we get 10 guys to talk about this? And we ended up, we would have been able to fill it two or three times over. Guys wanted to talk 4 years ago. We wouldn't have been able to fill that, but we really could have filled it a few times over. And we're going to draw upon those guys that we couldn't fit in last time into a bit of this series and future series. So we're going in the right direction, but you have to, as Sean said, sometimes you have to really sit back and think, if I was not in this space, are we making progress? And yeah, I believe we are. We definitely
And to
are.
Kieran, do those men tell you whether they've talked about their experiences at work when you're chatting with them?
Yeah. Yeah, a couple of them have. We've talked about it specifically, asked them how their work environments are. And we've had a mixed bag, I'd say, wouldn't you, Sean? Like, we've had some real horrific stories. The one in particular, one of the guys had quite a big disagreement with his work colleague and they were quite vicious to him about it, where others have been very supportive. So yeah, they are willing to talk about it. Those guys that are willing to talk about their fertility would definitely, in most cases, talk about their work-life experiences with it.
We actually mentioned you in when we talked to one of these guys. Literally what they were saying was everything that you are campaigning for. They were saying, oh, there was no clear policy and what I could find was buried in amongst the maternity leave and all that, and which is, as we all know, so triggering when you have to trawl through that to find if you're even, if there's even anything in place. Now, I just want to ask how things were for you with your workplace specifically. Did that cause any issues? Was there any kind of comment?
With me?
Yeah.
Well, I was working on a breakfast radio show, so I was like the opposite in that I couldn't, I was at work for 4:30 in the morning, so I couldn't do the early morning. So my day finished at like 12:30, and I think the last clinic appointment was 1:00, and I was an hour. We had treatment at the same clinic, didn't we, Sean? Like, I was an hour drive from where I was working to where I was. So my other half, I did a lot of it on my own, to be honest, because he was working even further away. And in terms of that management, I didn't say anything at work, so nobody really knew. I did say to the guys directly, because I was basically recording a show that had my name on the door, so there came the times with the treatment, with the trigger and certain things where you can't be in, where I had to say to them, this is what's going on, and therefore we pre-recorded some stuff, but I didn't want to tell my boss. I didn't want them to know. I said I was having medical treatment, which they just were like, weird, don't talk more about it. But my husband didn't say anything at work. It had quite a significant impact, I think, on our communication. We didn't really talk about it. We were very much rabbits in the headlights with it, because the way that we were treated, it felt he was very overlooked. He didn't feel seen or heard in any of it. That was kind of part of my motivation with the podcast, because he couldn't find anything online. Nobody was talking to him about it. Exchanges he had were like, you're the problem. He was a personal trainer and a health coach at the time and thought he was in peak fitness and peak shape. And I think that was a real eye-opener for the pair of us. Ultimately, our treatment worked the first time. So I know that's rare in a lot of our experience. Yet our struggles continued because we ultimately weren't in a position to continue with treatment. And we made the decision to donate our frozen embryos to science. So that was a period of decision-making, discussion, counselling, implications counselling, and ultimately that real head over heart that we had a son, we were trying to buy a house. Do we have money for treatment or do we have money to try and move forward? So I think in all of this, when we're talking about the mental health elements and the challenges that we all face. I know my husband found all of that very difficult because we both found it difficult, but I was trying to encourage more conversations about it. And at that point, I was doing the podcast, and the podcast for me was a big piece of my therapy. He'd not really talked to anybody and hasn't really over the last couple of years. He's found other ways to sort to deal with his mental health and has retrained and is in a much better place. And actually, for the first time this summer, I'm not sure when this is going out, but basically in August, I've put like a panel of people together at a festival called Green Man that he's going to come on and talk about his experience. So we've been joking about his first public conversation about it was when we both went to meet Jonathan Ramsay, who insisted on us both going. And my husband ended up interviewing Jonathan, which was one of my favorite podcast episodes. But in the summer, he's going to be on a panel with me talking about his experience then. So it'll be interesting to see how it goes because, he's not done it very much.
Brilliant. It'll be great for him. Like you said, how good the podcast has been for you navigating that. And actually, frozen embryos conversation is a very hard one. And I think perhaps a topic for a whole other episode, actually, because we're in that phase now. And it's, you kick that can down the road to a degree. And then when you have to face it, it's really hard.
We're in exactly the same situation. We've only got one, but it's a hard conversation to have, isn't it? Because it could be another little one sat there that would bring a lot of joy to our lives. Yeah. Another conversation.
I was just going to say on it, the timing part of this is so key, as is the whether or not you want to educate. Because I think part of what I've realized, and I think we do with our work, is we educate. And what you're doing with your podcast is you're educating. It's whether you've got the enough in you, the strength to be that educator of what it feels like, what it means, what it does. We've all kind of found that piece to be able to pay it forward. But if you're not there, you just can't, no matter how much you might want to. And I think in my case, with my other half, he's now there, but it's such a difference in timing.
Yeah, absolutely. I heard a quote once, I can't remember it, but something about you need your wounds to have healed before you can start going back and readdressing it rather than from an open wound. But yeah, I completely butchered that. But hopefully the message came across.
Nailed it, mate. You nailed it.
Yeah. When it comes to what you advocate for, when you speak to employers, what's the kind of gold standard policy that you'd be looking for? But to anyone who's listening, who is perhaps a line manager or CEO and someone who's involved in decision making at a company, what is a quick win that you could do now?
So when we're talking about policy, I think the whole point of it is that it's so much more than just a piece of paper that gathers dust that just sits there. For it to be really gold standard, you've got to be thinking wider than a policy. You've got to think about how you bring it to life and how do you shift the culture around this, because that's a big blocker to many people feeling comfortable to open up and seek that support. But the basics of the policy, it needs to be inclusive. So it needs to talk about the fact that this is a people issue. It needs to think about not just the person physically going through treatment, but the partner as well. We always encourage to avoid heteronormative language, and because we know that the LGBTQ plus community, their route to parenthood will very likely involve fertility treatment. So making sure that it's really inclusive. And also the work we do, a lot of consultancy around workplace policies, it's softening that language. Does someone really need to come and show you an appointment card for every single appointment? Or are you able to have that level of trust with your employee that they're not going to lie about something like this? One big part of what we look for is for that ability for people to take time off, ideally for that to be paid time off so that they're not having to use their annual leave, not at any financial detriment, and for there to be no limit around that. And there are some organisations now that are saying, look, you take the time that you need for those appointments. And there are others that still do amazing things. They will pay up to 10 days a year towards appointments, which is still much more than many organisations. But for people who are looking at a policy, the first thing they will look for is, okay, how am I going to practically manage this with work? So what am I entitled to? So we encourage that. We encourage a lot of flexibility and the ability to take it in hours, because often you don't need a full day off. And that helps both the person going through it. It helps the business as well. You've not then got people taking full days off sick to hide a two-hour appointment. And it gives the managers a framework as well, because I think the managers often, if you've never experienced this yourself, it's quite a scary conversation to have with your employee and to understand how to support them. So we always talk about this as though the policy is for employees to know what they're entitled to and how to seek that support, but it's also for the managers to have that framework to empower them and to ensure this consistency as well, that you've not got one manager in one part of the organization that's brilliant, will allow you to just take what you need, do everything you need to do. Another manager who's literally writing down every time they've been off and, oh, you've now triggered the absence policy, we're going to take you in for a disciplinary. And we have heard of that as well. So there's so many different aspects to it, but I think the really important part as well is then that signposting. So not just what you're entitled to, but how can you get further support? And an organization's job isn't to fix this for somebody, but what they can do is be that source of credible information. And we often signpost towards your podcast, for example. It's signposting towards things such as peer support within an organization. So we encourage connection groups. We have fertility champions in some organizations. And I suppose the policy is that foundation that an organization can then build on with the awareness raising, the education, the line manager support and the peer support. I think that's pretty much covering everything that we would look for. But what's amazing to see is that every organization has a different tone of voice and a different way of approaching it. And we've, rather than give them a template and say, this is exactly how it should look, we like to work with them and build on that. And they use our resources to build out those additional support signposts and everything else. So yeah, I think it's so much more than a tick box. We've got a policy, we move on. It's how do you keep people engaged within that policy longer term? And that sounds like a long process, but in terms of quick wins, there are things you can do, aren't there, Nat, in terms of just opening up that conversation initially.
We've seen brilliant examples where organisations have put out a survey and asked people questions. Mm. Listening to what people actually need, knowing who your people are, is the most significant thing that you can do, because only then can you then put the support in place. And I was at an employee wellbeing conference the other day, and there was an organisation talking about how they do mental health surveys every single week to their colleagues. So asking the questions, you don't have to have a load of money put behind that to just put out some surveys and actually have, is this a topic that you'd like more support on? Because when we started and we had some organisations saying nobody's talking about this, we were saying it's because they don't think they can talk about it. And so by giving people, again, we've said it a few times, that permission, we know it's 1 in 6 people worldwide, they're impacted. It's inevitable that unless there's only 2 people in your organisation, if we've got at least 6, we're probably going to be talking about somebody. So I would say a quick win is put out a survey, put out the feelers, open up the conversation, even start physically. Like one of our member organizations did a whole listening project, and that's how they then developed their policy and their manager's guidance. They were conducting like one-to-one interviews, have the conversations. And from the manager's perspective, it's then encouraging them to realize that this is probably a wider conversation, but that they don't have to fix it, because then we can start to put these different things in place. So listen is, I'd say, a quick win. Get talking.
It sounds, it's something so simple, isn't it? Listen to what the people need.
You think.
But people don't do it. I think we're guilty of it in society, not just with fertility. It's like there's an issue, ask what the issue is and we can figure out. But going back to what Becky said, your concern, the concerns you highlighted in terms of what should be in a policy and everything, I remember thinking about all of that. Like, how's this going to impact? How many days until I suddenly see a deduction in what I'm getting paid, but I've still got to have it? And is one manager or is my deputy head going to treat me differently to the head teacher? All these things that run through your brain. Once again, additional stress. Mm-hmm. I was lucky. They asked me what I needed. That's what Natalie said. It's just a simple question, isn't it? What do you need?
Yeah.
What do you need? And how, once you have that information, then you can act. Until you have that information, there's nothing you can do, is there? You're just guessing, especially if you've never been through it as an employer. Because as we all know, people that make decisions aren't always best placed to sometimes. You've got to have that data or that information to make a really informed decision about how to implement a policy or make a decision about a certain thing.
I've probably mentioned it before, but during our treatment, the initial people that I told, my line managers were so good, but I almost 2 years down the line now, so a year and a half of hiding it, about 6 months of then having that amazing support, I decided I needed a change in my role, and I did an internal change, went to a different team with the same organization, And my line manager was saying, don't go, I'll look after you. And I was like, it's not just about the fertility stuff. I just need a change. It was more stable hours. And we were coming to the end of my side of stuff. And I knew that it was going to pass Jenna and it was going to be all the injections and get more in, more scheduled side of the IVF journey. And within a week, I regretted it. Because I remember I was still at Bourne Hall at our clinic and it was an appointment during work time and my new line manager phoned me to ask how long am I going to be, when am I going to be back? And I'm an hour away from work as it is. And we were waiting for them we had to wait and then go back in. And you can imagine the stress that put me under. And I tried to go back after a week, I tried to go back to my previous role. They didn't let me. He said, give it a few more months, it'll be better. And waited a few more months, said, no, not happy. I just didn't have that ever happen. It's like you said, Becky, always had that feeling that I was an inconvenience and my appointments were an inconvenience. So after a few months, asked again to go back to my previous role and they wouldn't let me. So guess what? I left the organization. I literally quit.
And the power of a manager, isn't it? Just that the difference that made in approach and how they were with you. Ultimately left that you to leave. And that is what we always say. And this is the thing, when we're talking with organizations, we have to talk in the mindset of what's the data behind this? What's in it for them? What clear reason is there for them to invest in this and to really do something apart from you should because it's the right thing to do. But we often talk about the 1 in 6 figure, but we also talk about the fact that 36% of people considered leaving their jobs. And anecdotally, that was all around poor support. And so if we're thinking about talent retention and the cost of having to replace that knowledge and that talent within the business, that is huge.
Yeah.
We think about those absence levels. If nearly 70% of people are taking time off sick, that late notice sickness absence is much more disruptive than a planned conversation around flexible working. And what you always hear from speaking with people, and I think it's come through when you've been speaking, Kieran, is that loyalty and gratitude that you feel, and Sean, with your previous line manager, when you have been looked after in these difficult life events, and that pays long term. It's not just at that time. You feel this sense of gratitude because it is a really difficult time of your life. And like you say, there's no escape from it. Even many people, work is the only escape because you can go and you can focus on something else for a while, but it's still there the whole time. And so the power of a line manager, and that's where we are really passionate about that. How do we equip and empower line managers to sometimes they don't know what they don't know, but to have that empathy, to raise that awareness around this isn't just a medical procedure with a few injections and scans. It's a huge psychological experience that people go through, but also that it impacts not just someone going through treatment, it impacts the partner. It has a wider ripple effect that will actually mean that individual will be impacted at work. And what can you do? What's within your realm of power to support them on that day-to-day basis and just remove that burden, like that weight that you would have felt when you had that phone call, Sean?
You say the gratitude towards good people. So it was 2019 when I changed roles, latter end of it. I just had my micro-TZ. Like I said, it was all going to start shifting to Jenna. And so it's 2019 since I worked for those previous line managers. And it was mid-2020 when I left that organization. But I still speak to those line managers because they were just good people. And that's who you should keep in your life after 6 years. And of course, I haven't ever spoken to that other one again because it was a numpty. And just be a good human. You don't need to know the answers. If you're a line manager and someone comes to you with something like this and you have no experience of it, it doesn't matter. Remember why you're a line manager. Just manage the situation, hold the space, thank them for sharing it with you and say, I will go away and see what I can do for you. You don't need to know the answers there and then. You're not an AI bot. They're coming to you because you're a human and just be a human.
The other thing that we've heard is if people have had to be off, for example, from having pregnancy loss, we heard like an amazing example of someone whose team had got in touch with them to say, when you come back, how do you want the conversation to be dealt with? Do you want us to ask you about it? Or would you prefer to tell us how you're feeling? Because we don't want you to think that we're not acknowledging it. We're not going to we just want to know what's right for you. And this person was so bowled over that the team had been so considerate about that to give her the heads up in terms of when she was coming back. And equally, from the male perspective, we often hear men say they're asked how their partner is when there's been a loss.
Yeah.
And again, yeah, you're just trying to educate that colleague piece to be mindful of how people want to talk about it. And that first example, the person really thrived in their kind of route to recovery in coming back, because she just really felt. And then when there was later pregnancy announcements, they gave her a heads up. And so there's that mindfulness that instantly starts. And this cultural shift is what we're seeing with the organizations that we're supporting. And what they're also saying is that managers are going to these peer support groups and going to these kind of fertility champions that Becky mentioned and saying, is this the right way to approach this? So whilst we're saying about managers thinking about it and not having to fix it and not knowing it all, knowing who else they can talk to just helps. It's all just putting all these different touch points in so that the experience is better for all, ideally.
Yeah, for me, it would have made me less stress in the workplace if I just, obviously the bosses were great, but to know that it was, other people were mindful of the situation. Mm. You've said it perfectly, an athlete. So the fact of, they know what situation I'm in. They're just showing me a little bit of mindfulness, respect in terms of how I might feel. And when I would have needed to draw on it, I could. I think that's from a man's perspective. That's what we truly want. We just want that little, I don't quite know how to word it, but in terms of, there's something there if we need it, but we won't need it every day and we might never need it, but it's there if you need it. Someone's there to catch you if you need it just for a little while. Yeah. And that kind of leads me on to what I was going to ask you next is, what would you really like to see in terms of employers, maybe legislation around it? Because at the moment, my understanding is there's nothing currently written in law that has any kind of fertility guidelines in it.
You're right. There's no legal route to take that time off for fertility treatment appointments. You are simply left to the goodwill of your employer if you decide to tell them. And I think this is where it leaves people feeling very vulnerable, actually. And we've been campaigning in Parliament for the last few years, and we've been trying to get an amendment to the Employment Rights Bill, and we're just trying to get just a small change in place to recognise that for those people going through fertility treatment, there are multiple appointments that can't be taken in annual leave. It doesn't work that way. And one thing that we are trying to change is the Equality and Human Rights Commission have a code of practice which is used, is basically for employers to interpret the employment law. And the current code of practice has an example that likens a woman going through IVF to a man having cosmetic dental surgery in his annual leave. And that is the basis that a lot of these policies form from. So we've seen policies that say if you're having IVF or cosmetic dental surgery such as Invisalign, then you need to take this in your own time. You've got to sort it out. It's an elective procedure that you're choosing to do. And this is something we're saying at the moment, that's fundamentally wrong, that there is no comparator really that out there. And so that is a big thing we're trying to change. But we really want, this is a bit like antenatal leave, that you have that statutory right to be able to go for those appointments. Your partner can come along as well. And you know that you're not going to be treated favourably as a result of that. The problem is with fertility treatment appointments, there's not that protection. And there is, so for the woman at the point of embryo transfer, you are then protected under pregnancy legislation. But for any appointments leading up to that, you are left. And I spoke to someone recently. It was a couple, and he had a brilliant employer who had been really supportive and allowed him to go to all the appointments, no questions asked, everything else. She had a manager who was really supportive, but then changed managers. That new manager decided that, no, you shouldn't be given paid time for those. You should be taking them as sick leave. Oh, by the way, now, retrospectively, you've triggered the absence policy. You need to come in for a disciplinary. And she ultimately left her job. But there's nothing out there in law to say that shouldn't happen. So that's what we're really trying to do, to have just the basics. And put in place so that people don't have to fear for their jobs whilst they're going through this. And actually, not to just put the onus on employers to voluntarily do this, to say this should be the norm, this should be what all organisations do, because I think I mentioned earlier, you'll have your middle management office jobs that are probably more likely to sign up to things that we do with Fertility Matters at Work and put these things in place. But then you'll have your shift workers, you'll have those on the factory floor, you'll have those working in the NHS. We hear so many stories from the NHS that just don't have that level of support. So it needs to be available to everybody, I think, who's going through this. And I think we're still a way off, sadly. I think we've got MP support, but it's finding the right time to get that legislation through. But we're just going to keep banging the drum and seeing where we get to with it.
Thank you. Thanks for banging the drum. I don't know if it's too early for this question, but you've obviously been doing it for a few years, but have you had any data about recruitment and retention and how companies that have changed their policies, or even not even if it's a policy change, but just have brought in better practices, have they seen any improvements?
We've currently got our survey that's out and it ends this week. So by the time people are listening to this, our kind of research will be out there. I'm on recent survey that we've run, but actually there was a stat that really stood out for me. We actually learned this statistic by chance, but we did some work with Zurich. It was around the end of 2022 and they'd introduced their new policy and they were wanting to talk about it in the media. And so they partnered with us to almost be like a spokesperson for why this was important. And I know, Natalie, you ended up on BBC News and Sky News talking about this, and they had some really good publicity around what they'd put in place. And it was only after that event that I think you bumped into somebody on that campaign.
I was out having a drink where I live in Altrincham in Manchester. And a guy came up to me and told me that he was the head of comms for the agency that Zurich had used to do the media interviews. And that as a result of the conversation, and it was a piece of research that they were talking about, we were the kind of talking head on their behalf, they'd had an 11% increase in hits to their careers page and to their recruitment pages, which they were directly linking back to this. And I know that we're seeing that there's, I think it's about 49% of Gen Z are looking for this type of awareness raising or support in organizations when they're looking at where they're going to go. So we're still piecing all the different elements together. But from the members that we know that are doing it, we know that the feedback that they're getting internally is that people are saying they feel more supported. And so that loyalty piece is, the ripple effect is going on. Don't know if there's more stats that you've got, Becky.
I think some of these things are not tangibly measured as well. It's how people feel, and it's very hard to capture. But I know for the organisations that we are working with, just the transformational feedback that they are receiving literally live on the webinars when we're hosting them, where people are saying, and we've even had managers reach out to us after events to say, thank you, I had absolutely no idea. And I was supporting someone last year and there were so many things I could have done better. And I'm going to take that now and use that as I go forward. And I think it's just knowing that you've hopefully made that experience better for somebody in the future. And that's, I think, why we all do what we do. It's to make that path smoother. And yeah, we can't fix the fertility side of things, but we can hopefully help change attitudes. And I think that's a big part of what we try and do, change those attitudes towards this, that we try and really bring to life what it means to go through it as well, that psychological, emotional impact, because this is so much more than just a medical procedure. It's your life, isn't it? And it is life altering, these diagnoses and how we go through them and our careers.
I think as well, just to add on that, the longevity of this conversation that we have with our members, we explain that you can't rush it. It has to evolve. And part of that messaging that we encourage our organisations to say to their people is that this is an ongoing conversation. And what we often hear is people are living, that they're learning from the lived experience and feeding back to us. So we've, for example, got a number of breweries that we work with. So in the FMCG sector, and there's conversations now amongst them trying to raise awareness within their sector with almost live cases. So we talked about being in an office compared to in the field. They want to highlight the challenges that like a field rep or a factory worker my experience. And we've done also a lot of work with the utilities sector, and they're looking at what happens if people are out in vans. We talked about Jenna having to inject in Euston lose. What does it mean if your job is you out in the field? How do you inject? And so all of that insight is being shared back to us from our member organizations, and that members community are sharing amongst each other. And so ultimately, they're paying it forward with what they're learning all the time, because we only know what we know should be happening. But until we're hearing, again, it's that listening piece, we're hearing the challenges people are facing. How are they speaking to, if you're a retailer, how are you talking to people that are stocking shelves and they don't have access to a computer? How do you communicate to them that there is a policy, there is the support, there is the peer support? And that's what we're then feeding back to other organizations. So we're joining the dots for our members that directly, but those across different sectors as well.
What I've learned today is that it not only benefits the employee, but it benefits the employer. And I can't fathom why this hasn't been picked up quicker. I'm sat here and Kim, all the evidence is there. All the evidence is there. Yeah. And it's time for government to step up, but also employers to take it in their own hands. They've got the power to do this. And it's not just a central government thing. This is an individual employer thing. So the work you're doing, ladies, is amazing. And we will bang that drum with you as much as we can. And if you need anything from us, please let us know. It's been an absolutely amazing discussion. Really opened my eyes. And I hope people that are listening to this have gained some strength and some understanding of what they should expect from their employer and how maybe to approach those conversations and that you're there to support them as well.
And there's free resources on our website. So if things such as we've got a download around what a typical IVF cycle looks like and what you might need, and you can use these resources to almost give you a little bit more of a script if you're speaking to your manager or you're speaking to your organization, because it can be hard when it's an emotional topic to find the words to say, this is what I need. So there are downloads, we've got a white paper, we've got how to build your business case for this. So there's lots of different things to help.
We've got a podcast that Sean's actually spoken on before. So we've got a podcast that's the F Word at Work that can almost be the voice to your manager. We've seen such brilliant examples of this being championed by those with lived experience in their place of work. So use our resources to get your kind of employer talking about it as well. And we'll make sure you've got some of those links to pop in your show notes.
Yeah, definitely. So we always finish the podcast with asking one question, and that is, if you could give one bit of advice to a guy that's facing fertility challenges, let's put it in the workplace, what bit of advice would you give him? So let me go with Becky first.
So you'd come to me first. I'm sure probably the biggest piece of advice that always comes out on this podcast is just talk, find somebody within your organization. It doesn't have to be your manager if you don't feel comfortable. Someone who you trust that you can share this with, so that if you've been to an appointment, things haven't gone to plan and you're really struggling to put that face, you've got an outlet and you've got somebody who can say, look, just go and take 5 minutes. I'll cover this for you. Just have that support. Don't feel like you have to go through it on your own. And I think you'd always be surprised how many people have their own experience as well, which I know has come up throughout this episode.
Yeah.
I'd probably add, and I'm going to steal it from something that we heard, because I imagine that because there's gender disparity in how this conversation is perceived, that it's a female issue, that men are more likely to be asked why they need the time off to go to an appointment. So we had someone say to us that a man say that they wanted to be present at the conception of their child. It's almost like having those sound bites that make you feel, it's your toolkit, it gives you that power. And if you've got that sentence front and center, if someone says, why do you need to go? Say that, and I challenge anybody at the receiving end to go.
You would see the cogs turning.
I know.
Yeah.
That's what I love about it.
What? Yeah, it's brilliant. That is absolutely brilliant.
It's a great way to end the episode.
That's a perfect way. Thank you so much, ladies. It's been a real pleasure. We knew this was going to be a good episode, and it's been fantastic. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If this episode has helped you, do us a quick favour and leave us a review. You don't even have to use your real name. Every single review helps another man find this show when he needs it the most. It's honestly the best way you can help the next guy. If you've got a question or something you'd like us to cover on the mailbag, drop us an email at themalefertilitypodcast@gmail.com.
We read every message and we love hearing from our listeners. And if you'd like a bit more expert guidance and support from other men on the same journey as you, you're welcome to join our free private community at nexusfertility.com. It's totally confidential and designed just for you by guys that get it. For our latest updates, follow us on social media at the Male Fertility Podcast. And remember, gents, you're not on your own.